As a political scientist, I conduct research on the U.S. Congress, congressional elections, and women in politics. But I started thinking about these questions before I got my PhD in political science. From 1993 to 1998, I worked for two different congresswomen in Washington, D.C., one Democrat and one Republican, so sort of an unusual perspective. Great for an academic, I tell my students, maybe not so great for a political career. But I saw up close the ways in which congresswomen navigated a male-dominated institution in the mid-1990s. They faced some challenges that their male colleagues did not, but they also took advantages of opportunities to raise policy issues that disproportionately affect women and that had been previously ignored. I observed the way in which they worked with other congresswomen, sometimes within their own party and sometimes across party lines, to be effective agents for change. In the 1990s, there weren't very many women in Congress or very many women serving nationwide. And just as the number of women serving in office has grown, so has research on women in politics advanced considerably since I worked on Capitol Hill in the mid-1990s. In the 2018 elections, a record number of women ran for the U.S. Congress and a record number of women won. 126 women out of 535 serve in the current U.S. Congress, or 24% of the Congress. A record 47 are women of color. There is, however, a growing partisan gap. In the early 1990s, women comprised an equal share of each party in Congress. In the House of Representatives today, of the 102 women serving in the House, only 13 are Republicans. Of the 36 new women elected in 2018 to the House, only one is a Republican. Of the 24 women in the U.S. Senate, only 7 are Republicans. In the Minnesota State Capitol, women comprise 32% of the House and Senate combined. In the two chambers, there are 45 Democratic women and 19 Republican women. With women comprising 24% of the legislature in Washington and 32% in Minnesota, women remain dramatically underrepresented at every level of office, despite recent gains. Many scholars have asked, why are women underrepresented? And it's important to know that when women run for office, whether for the U.S. Congress or for state legislature, women win at the same rate as men. This is true in primary elections, and it is also true in general elections. It's also true in state legislatures. So women's underrepresentation is caused by a dearth of women running for office. And this is not surprising when you look at additional research. Women are less likely to be recruited to run for office by political parties and gatekeepers. In part, this is because party leaders don't think women can win in all districts, only some types of districts. And women with the same professional qualifications as men are less likely to see themselves as qualified. And this isn't just true of accomplished professionals today, it is also true of my undergraduate students. In anonymous surveys that I give them, these are all upper division political science majors, in anonymous surveys, I ask them if they plan to run for office and if they think they will be qualified to run for office within 10 years. And there is a huge gap between the men and the women in my classes in terms of their own self-perceived qualifications within 10 years. And I can tell you, the men are actually not even doing as well as the women in terms of their actual grades. And so these gender differences sort of start young and they persist throughout women's careers. When women run for office, research shows that women face stereotypes about their beliefs and their competencies. Men are seen as more agentic, more like a typical leader. Women are seen as more compassionate. Men are seen as better on issues of national security. Women are seen as better on issues of healthcare and social welfare. Women are seen as more liberal, regardless of their actual ideology. Now, not all these stereotypes are harmful, and in fact, in certain circumstances, they can advantage women in the electoral process. But they can be very harmful depending on the district a woman is running in, and more to the point, women should be judged on their own qualifications and ideas, not on the basis of gender stereotypes. Once in office, research shows that women bring different perspectives and life experiences to policymaking. Women are more likely to sponsor and co-sponsor bills on issues that disproportionately affect women, such as breast cancer research, violence against women, issues affecting women in military service, and abortion on both sides of the issue. It wasn't until a bipartisan group of congresswomen in the 1990s got together that the National Institutes on Health started including women in important research and clinical trials and established the Office of Women's Health. Women also work harder in Congress, so they're actually not making trade-offs between issues affecting women. They're just working harder. Research shows that every Congress, women introduce more bills than men do, give more speeches on the House floor, and women bring more federal money back to their districts. And in the speeches that both Democratic and Republican women give on the House floor, they're more likely to talk about women and girls. So not necessarily just on speeches about women's issues, but discuss the policy implications of legislation going through the chamber on women in particular. Women face unique challenges in male-dominated institutions. At times, women may face discrimination, but sometimes it's more subtle. Research shows that women are more likely to be interrupted during committee hearings. And at times, women indicate that they need to work harder to prove themselves to their colleagues and constituents alike. The last point I want to make is that research today shows that women are not immune from the intense partisan polarization on Capitol Hill and in politics today. We've heard some encouraging stories coming out of Washington, D.C. about women senators across party lines forging compromise on some of the thorny issues that the Senate and House face. And while it does happen, the reality is women in both parties vote with their parties and against the other party just as often, if not more so, than men on Capitol Hill do. Women have the same strategic incentives as men to appeal to party leaders in Washington and at home and to prove their partisan credentials. Speaker Pelosi does a better job of bringing Democrats together to forge consensus than previous Democratic House speakers. She's known for all the listening sessions that she has, for really working very closely with different factions within the party, but she is fiercely partisan when it comes to dealing with Republicans. The Congressional Caucus for Women's Issue does meet periodically and hold hearings on issues like women in small business and women internationally, but they tend to stay away from any issues that are party priorities or issues that divide the parties. So the partisan climate is real in Washington and I suspect in Minnesota, and it affects women's abilities to work across party lines as women have traditionally done through congressional caucuses. But now I am delighted to turn to the women who have actually run for and served in office to give us their perspective on running for and serving in office. So first, former Representative Erin Murphy.
Thank you, Professor Pearson. And thank you, everybody, for being here. And thank you to the Humphrey for hosting this. I am really thrilled to be here and know I have about 10 minutes. And Representative Loon will have about 10 minutes, and then we're going to do some Q&A. And I already feel like there's so much to talk about, and we won't have enough time. So I hope this isn't our last, and I know that Humphrey has been dedicated to this topic, among others, for many years. So it's great that we're here today. I want to begin by making sure you hear clearly from me how important it is that you are a part of our small d democracy, how important it is that you are participating in whatever form or fashion that you see fit in our politics today, and if you're thinking about it, that you actually consider and prepare to run for office. I have been fortunate in the 12 years that I have been serving in the Minnesota House of Representatives, running for office, not only for my own election, but helping other people across the state get elected, to see over and over again, despite many of the things that Professor Pearson just laid out, and they are alive and well in the House chamber and across the state of Minnesota and across our politics. Despite that, I have seen over and over again the very best of us as people in my work in politics. And there's every reason to hope for our capacity to continue to build a future for the people of Minnesota if we tend to our small d democracy. And if we, the people, step away from that and allow the practiced voices, not just incumbents, but the operatives, the parties, the caucuses, to drive the conversation going forward. If we're not a part of that and we're not centering our politics in our real lives, then we will continue, I think, to have an emptiness in politics that looks more like a fight, more like a us versus them kind of fight, and not nearly enough a discussion, a conversation, and a real debate about what our future looks like. It will take all of us to do that, and I want you to hear first and foremost from me as we talk today how engaged and committed I am to that for our future. And I hope that you leave here feeling that very same way, because we need you. Minnesota needs you. We need all of us together in our politics. Served 12 years in the Minnesota House. Never, ever thought I was going to run. Ran after I took care of my mom at the end of her life. I grew up in a family that loved to talk about politics, but I was not ever in my mind a candidate, not a comfortable public speaker, but was really ticked off at what I saw happen to my mom when she was really sick and getting denied some of her coverage. So without really thinking about it, I plugged in and decided to run for office, and then learned that I wasn't a very good candidate, and I had a lot to learn in order to win my first race, which was super competitive. It's interesting to me that my very first race for the Minnesota House and my very last race running for governor, very, very competitive. And in both those cases, I grew as a candidate, in part because of the pushing that I got from the people all around me, the people of Minnesota. That competition part of politics is important. It helps us grow. I have seen, you know, I've served six terms, three in the majority, three in the minority, much of it in leadership, once as the majority leader. I have grown through all of those experiences, and I would confess to you, if we had more time, the number of mistakes that I made that taught me that I am both a partisan, I'm someone who's fighting for what I believe in, standing up for my values and the things that I think that are important for Minnesota, but also that with all humility, it is important to continue to nurture relationships with people across the aisle. Some terms I was really good at that, other terms I was not that good at that. And it's something that Minnesotans really want. And so when we push back on legislative bodies or on elected officials and ask them and nudge them toward working more collaboratively, not going back to our partisan caucuses and doing battle from there, but pushing us together, you will see more of that come out of legislative bodies. There were all sorts of things, and I could go through story after story of things that I've heard from people. You know, I wasn't tough enough. I would never go for the throat. I wouldn't go for the jugular when I was given the chance. I wasn't willing to work on a tough issue. I think my record speaks for my capacity to do those things despite some of the perceptions that people have of women, and they still exist inside the Capitol. I did a lot of work over 12 years' time, as did Representative Loon, recruiting candidates, and I think that's where I saw most often our biases about who's electable. I would hear when I found someone interested in running for office who was a woman, a person of color, someone who was young, depending on where they lived, that was a person who couldn't get elected. And I think when a campaign is waged on the question of electability, and we're starting to see that narrative emerge in the 2020 presidential race, when we see electability as the goal, it allows us to house our biases without really questioning them. They can hang out inside our heads without really thinking about what does that mean if they say she can't win. I will tell you, in the governor's race, which was transformative for me, and on balance, despite losing, one of the most powerful things I've ever been a part of, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. I countered and countered all the time, well, I don't know if you can win, because Minnesotans have never elected a woman. People, women would say to me, sort of embarrassed and ashamed about it. My gender was not the only reason that I didn't succeed in the primary, but it was one of the reasons. So was my name recognition, so was my capacity to raise money. We raised a lot, but not enough. We worked harder, we got in sooner, and we campaigned in a way that I'd always hoped we could do it. We stayed positive. We were focused with purpose on the hard issues that we face. We engaged in a credible way all across the state of Minnesota. And by the time we got through the convention, we were known as the Campaign of Joy, in part because I danced on the stage. But what we saw in that was a real appetite on the people, on the part of the people of Minnesota, all across the state of Minnesota, where they felt in that campaign that they were powerful, powerful agents for themselves, where they believed that they, with us, could make the kind of change that we needed to make on tough issues like climate and healthcare and race and equity, the things that aren't always the subject of every campaign. So for me, what I learned, right, is there is an imbalance. There is a gender differential. The Barbara Lee Foundation, which has done a lot of research on this issue, and you can go take a look at it, they have worked very long and hard looking specifically at the question of women running for executive office. And I agree with Professor Pearson that when women run They win in the same numbers, especially for legislative seats and congressional seats. But it is not the case for women that are running for executive seats. We're seeing more progress here in the state of Minnesota for women running for mayor. It's awesome when you think about Mayor Larson, Mayor Norton, Betsy Hodges. But we've yet to see a woman win the office of governor in the state of Minnesota. We've yet to see a woman win the office of the presidency. And isn't it exciting to see so many women competing this time? It is. It is a good thing that it's not just one, but many. That gives me a lot of hope. But when we think about that question of electability and how that houses our biases, if we close our eyes and we think, and now I will use my partisan voice, we have to win the next presidential race because this president is troubled. If we think about that and we let the fear of that question sink in, and that we think we have to elect somebody that can win, we close our eyes, we think male. Just natural. That is work that we have to unpack. We have to talk about it more. That's why I'm glad we're here today. Because women, obviously, are just as capable. We bring our own unique skills and voices. And when the Minnesotans that we know are represented in our capital, or Americans are represented fully in the capital in the United States, when we think about our gender, our sexuality, our age, our geography, when we think about all of those, and that is well represented in the halls of the Capitol, then the result for the people of Minnesota and for America is more representative, and it's a better way to build our future. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Representative Jennifer Loon.
Well, thank you. I think we should give Erin a round of applause.
Thank you.
And quickly, I'd just like to say thank you to the Humphrey Institute and to Professor Pearson and to my friend Erin Murphy, who I had the pleasure of serving with for 10 years. If people are disheartened with all the partisanship that's going on in our politics, and I would share that view, it is still possible to be friends, and I made a lot of friends, and Erin's one I would consider from my time in the House. So I'll add a little bit to what Erin said and maybe take it in a slightly different direction. I served for 10 years. I left involuntarily after this last election. I lost by 241 votes. It was the best job I have ever had. I loved my public service. Even when it was hard and, days you would leave the Capitol or you'd get to the end of a session and say, that's it, I'm not running again, And we all had those moments, I said the worst time to recruit someone or to encourage a member to run again is at the end of the session. Give it time. You need time to go home and just reconnect with your family. But no, I loved it, and I've been doing a lot of thinking about what I'm going to do next, and what does this mean, and people have said, well, what are you interested in doing now? And so I've had to do a lot of deep searching about what is it that I felt like I developed or had as skills that were useful in the legislature, and what did I love most about that job? And to boil it down as far as possible, it's problem solving. I like working with other people, and I like problem solving. And that is so much of what legislative work is when you get down to it. You've got to be able to work with lots of different people, which I very much enjoy, figuring out what's important to them and then how you can solve a problem with all these different things that are important to different people and include enough elements that enough people will buy into the solution. So I think women are really, really good at that. And not that men aren't good at it, but I think women often approach it in a different way. There's a little less I and a little more we when we get into trying to craft solutions. I think women care a little bit less about getting the credit for things as long as the solution is something that is workable and helps solve a problem and helps do something good in your community or in your state. And I just, again, just from years of observing this, I just think it's true. I think also I observed that there is partisanship. Obviously, everyone comes. When you run for the legislature, you have to run under a party designation, and we can get into that more, but that was a change that was made a number of years ago. I actually think we should go back and not run with party designation so that people focus a little bit more on the individuals running versus party affiliation, which I think is too connected to national politics, which is abysmal right now. But I think women, oftentimes I would find more women colleagues that would be willing to question maybe a position of their party or look at solutions that would be considered maybe not in line with party platform. I did find that often in serving in my seat in the legislature. So similar to Erin, and I first ran in 2008. It was an open seat. Congressman Eric Paulson, at that point he was the legislator in the seat that I ran for, was decided to run for Congressman Ramstead, who was retiring his seat. I have worked in politics, or legislative, I will say legislative affairs, my entire career. I studied political science in college. I did an internship in Washington, D.C., went and worked out there. Loved working for elected officials. I never considered running myself until I was approached about it. And then I put off requests to think about that for 3 months. And it was a couple of things. I think first was, I'm not sure I could do this or win. You know, there's a lot of pressure to take a seat that's been held by someone for 14 years. And, you know, what if you're the first Republican to lose this seat? And actually ended up being that 10 years later. But, you know, what? How could I do this? And I had youngish kids at home at the time, a fifth grader and a ninth grader. And the other was also having worked in politics enough, I knew what I was getting into. I knew exactly what it meant to be a candidate, to put yourself out there, all that was involved. And so I didn't take that lightly. But, you know, I did eventually take the leap, and I'm really, really glad I did. I had a chance to do things that I would have never had the opportunity to do. But it was hard from every step of the way. When I first put my name in the hat to run, and it started even with sort of the endorsing conventions that go on, I had, you know, interviews with party leaders, and a man said to me, well, if you run for this seat, who's going to be the mom at your house? And I said, well, I still get to be the mom, you know. I will just be the mom who goes to work at the Capitol versus, you know, other jobs I had had. And I'd always worked full-time. I took 6 years off when my kids were really little until the youngest was in all-day school. But other than that, I've always been a working mom. So that was not unusual. So I can't imagine a man being asked who would be the dad at his house if he was running. So just to give you a little example, and again, this was 10 years ago, but I'm sure similar comments are still made when women consider running, especially if they have very, very young children. I'm sure that's a sentiment that, you know, crosses people's minds, even if they may not say it out loud anymore, but it's certainly out there. So, but I think, and that notion of not being prepared, or can I and my family make these sacrifices, and there are sacrifices to be made when you run for office, is something I think that weighs more heavily on women than men. I think, you know, in trying to recruit women to run, it is always a question, is whether or not I am asking too much of my partner, too much of my children to go through this. I think that is something that we really need to help women or potential women candidates think about, and those of us who have been through it to do a lot more to talk to potential candidates about, yes, you can do this. You can have a family. You can run for office. It's just like the same juggle that, you know, every other woman who works outside their home goes through. It's not unusual. I mean, there are a few circumstances that can be a little bit different, but it is certainly doable. And to be supportive of women thinking about doing that, I think, is incredibly important. And, you know, also for anybody thinking about running for office, I think it's a noble calling and much needed, and unfortunately too much maligned, as people say, well, you're just another politician. We need bright, capable people who will run, and that's how we bridge the gap of partisanship and how we work towards solving problems. Without that, you end up with just sort of the rancor and divisiveness and just deep disappointment that I think exists in our political system right now. So I would say we need to do a lot more to bolster women and their confidence and their abilities. I actually think women who often are not sort of schooled or their experience is based in partisan politics, but more in community activities, are actually better candidates or better suited to running for office, in my personal opinion. I think you run across a lot more people that way. I think you develop a lot more relationships with people regardless of the citizens' political views. You know them on a different level, which helps you not only run successfully, but also to have a better gauge of the variety of opinions and people in your community. And so I think sometimes looking for people to run who would be outside the general scope, you know, you're not just looking to party activists to run, but you're looking for other people who have been active in your community are great ways to start. I think encouraging girls starting in school and really working on civic engagement of children, but especially girls, is another great way to try to bridge that gap and move us forward. So, I'll leave it at that. I think I'd be more interested in hearing questions from the audience and what's on your mind. So,
thank you.
I will start with a question to both of our panelists. What do you think specifically that your party could do to both recruit and encourage more women to run and more women to be engaged in politics? I mean, right now there's a pretty big gap between the two parties, but I also think it's clear that both parties have some work to do, especially as party leaders in different parts of the state have different ideas about who's electable. That is a really powerful quote from former Representative Murphy: electability allows us to house our biases without reflecting on them. And so if you could both reflect on what your parties, both in the legislature and party leaders, could do to encourage more women to run and to get more women in office, that would be great.
You know, this is a kind of a big soul-searching question, I think, for the Republican Party, very honestly, right now. As a lifelong Republican, I feel like the party is just in a very dark place right now that emanates from national politics. And so, very candidly, I'm not a supporter of President Trump. I didn't vote for him. I think he's been very damaging to the brand. I think in the absence of Trump, I probably would still be in my seat right now. But the anger over him, I think, overshadowed a lot of other thoughts about candidates on the ballot, people who had won. I mean, I won my previous election with 62.5% of the vote. And I never got less than 58% of the vote in any race I ran. In my district. And I've had many people tell me, I really like you and I've always voted for you. If you change your party affiliation, I'll vote for you again. Now, that doesn't make me a different person and probably wouldn't make me vote a whole lot differently, but I just think that's an issue that's very real right now for the party and especially in certain areas of Minnesota. So, you know, I think we can go and try to recruit more people, but I think the effort really has to be how you are branded and how you present yourself to the voters and what it means, again, to be affiliated with a political party, mm-hmm. and what it doesn't mean if you're affiliated with a political party. And those are very hard distinctions to make when so much of politics, again, is dominated by national points of view when you're looking at more local races. And also just facing up to a very polarizing figure within your party.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. And exit polls suggested that a majority of voters in 2018 saw their vote as a referendum on the president, who of course was not on the ballot, but the way to do that was to vote for or against Republican candidates, depending on their positions. So, yeah.
We had a similar experience in 2010. I think we lost 25 seats in our caucus that year. It is the case that our races are becoming much more nationalized, and the amount of money that's being spent in legislative races, not by candidates, but by outside groups, is reinforcing that and making it much harder, I think, for people to sort through or even engage. I have so many clear recollections of Minnesotans who would come to the door with a pile of lit, and I'm lucky I've represented a district that has not been very competitive in our elections, so I have not experienced what I bet Representative Loon experienced in this last election, where there is an avalanche of mail that comes into a district, and it's really hard for people to sort that out. So on top of the national message and the mood, then there is this interference of a lot of information coming into people's mailboxes and their televisions that don't really help us discern. That is the party apparatus. It is the party apparatus. And when I think about the DFL party, which I've been a part of, you know, for my life, their job is to win the next election. And they are working with a great big pen, a great big crayon, and not a really refined pencil. And we need more refinement. And if there aren't others in the arena or in the environment that are willing to draw out that the sophistication, if you will, the refinement that we need when we think about candidates or messaging or the way campaigns are being conducted, we'll just continue to march in this direction. So when you think about a caucus, which is a part of a party, they want to fill every seat and they want to win every election. And that reinforces we just have to keep doing the same thing. So we're having a big debate in Minnesota. We're continuing to have a big debate about urban and rural. You know, in greater Minnesota, we have to have a man, a farmer, not a person of color, or a Democrat can't possibly win. We're seeing the urban and rural divide being used in our elections in order to win elections, which doesn't help governing at all. In fact, it undermines governing significantly. So when you think about the parties, their job is to protect what they have. Incumbents, their job is to look for something that's familiar, that's most electable, and that is meeting up with, I think, what gets me excited about the politics of today. People who are willing to engage and fight for the things that they believe in, that sense of urgency, young people who are not willing to wait anymore and are willing to fight for the things that they believe in, people of color saying, I want to be a part of, I'm not willing to wait anymore, and they're busting through some of those conventions, and that's how we see long-term incumbents losing their seats. But it's not coming from the parties, it's coming from the people. And I think the parties have got to wake up and get their finger on that pulse and navigate that in order to build a better governance for the state of Minnesota.
Great. Thank you. We have a lot of terrific questions coming in. I'm going to start with this one. You spoke about how women legislators bring a somewhat different style and tone to their work. In your time at the Capitol, have you seen anything similar among women lobbyists in media or reporters?
I want to say that I was a lobbyist for the nurses before I was a legislator, so I have a lot of experience with that part of the policymaking process. And largely, I was disappointed by seeing the tactics being used at the end of session in particular, regardless of gender, both men and women who were comfortable in the power that they had and their ability to disrupt or interrupt the policymaking process at the end. And demanding sometimes my, not just attention, but my action because of a relationship that we had in place. I'm not a young person anymore. And you think you've been around the block a lot. And I'll tell you, when I was the majority leader, I saw some things that I'd only heard about and didn't really know existed that actually, you know, were happening. And it was both men and women in the lobbying sphere that were driving that. In terms of the media, I actually think I observe some of the same behavior that I feel driven by in my work as a legislator. I see that same behavior in the media, right? So instead of leading from yourself, making sure the people around you can see that you're tough by pushing beyond where you're comfortable. I've seen that sometimes in our media where rather than getting to the question that they want to ask, kind of digging in on something that will make the subject of the question uncomfortable to prove a kind of toughness that I've seen as well.
Thank you.
No, thanks. I guess I would tend to agree a little bit. There is always a little more pressure, I think, especially on the party in power to try to, you know, help your friends who helped you get there, especially when you get down to brass tacks at the end of session and a lot of final legislation is being written and pushed forward. But by and large, I don't know that it separates across gender lines. In fact, I don't think it really does. I mean, I think lobbyists have a role to play in the process because of the volume and breadth and width of things that legislators deal with and knowing where every piece is along the track. There's a lobbyist who will know because they're following it specifically. But I think there is a real difference between lobbyists who do their job very well, ethically and just professionally are very astute, versus a few, and I think it probably is a few, that are just not very good. And most legislators learn pretty quickly who you can trust and who you don't want to do business with again, who you don't want to talk to, who you're not going to be working with. And I think that is sort of a clear separation, more so than gender. In the whole sphere of reporters and the media, I think we are now seeing some more political reporters who are women. I think it's been primarily male-dominated, at least in my experience. We're starting to see some more. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see even more. There's just the media in general tends to be a little more of the whole gotcha, a little more sensationalizing the news or making it sexier, however you want to call it. And maybe not as much good sort of in-depth reporting, especially on the legislature. I mean, I think for many of us, we feel like we labored sort of in anonymity, except for, I mean, the local paper would do an article at the beginning of session and one at the end of session. And in between those 5 months, who knows what you worked on? Because it also wasn't something that the major papers of the area was going to cover unless it was really kind of big news. And so I think there's a real dearth of information out there in a lot of the major media streams about what goes on at the legislature and who's working on what.
Great. Thank you. The next topic I want to cover is fundraising and campaign finance. If you look at congressional elections, if you look at similarly situated incumbents, challengers, open seat candidates, men and women actually raise on average the same amount of money. If there are any differences, is that women in some cycles raise slightly more money than men. Yet there is also research that shows that women work harder, literally do more types of fundraising, more ask to raise that money. And so part of the reason that men and women win congressional elections at the same rate is because women raise as much or more money, and women are also more likely to have previous political experience when they run for Congress. And so I'm interested in hearing your perspectives on raising money and campaign finance in state legislative elections and Representative Murphy in the gubernatorial election as well.
I think for me as a candidate, and I think this was true a lot of people, it's probably one of the hardest things. I mean, it's just not a comfortable space for a lot of people to be asking money for your campaign or for yourself, it feels like. So I think maybe the fact if women maybe raise a little more, it's because they've been schooled in the knowledge that having an adequately funded campaign is essential. It's very hard to win a race if you're underfunded. It just is. And so I think it speaks to maybe women being well prepared if they're undertaking a run for Congress, and also just by virtue of the work ethic, which you've pointed out, Dr. Pearson, and through your research, that they just work really hard. And so I don't know that there's any magic to it other than that.
I would agree with that. I would be, along with so many Americans, think there's too much money in our politics today, and it would be great if one of the key factors that we were competing over wasn't our ability to raise money. But it is the case right now. I am still in my mind unpacking the experience of 2018. I have been raising money for my campaigns for a long time, like Representative Loon, not my favorite thing to do, but knew I had to do it. It was important, and I would be measured on it. But from the very beginning of the race, I was not the favored or establishment candidate, and a lot of the early money that came from Democrats who wanted to make sure that we were going to win didn't contribute to my campaign with our success. And as we grew more competitive and more successful, then that changed for us. And in the summer, we were able to equalize a lot of the competitive disadvantage that we were facing, though we never really closed that gap. And I'm sure that that was a factor in our loss in the primary. But I would hear often, I just don't think you can win, so I'm not going to invest in you. And it was hard to get off the phone and into a meeting, especially with somebody I didn't know very well, to make the case. Because for some, I was, just never going to be able to compete because I don't look like what we think of when you think about a governor in the state of Minnesota.
There's a series of questions about sort of women, how monolithic are women, what happens when women run against each other, is there a women's vote? And so if you could both reflect on your support from men and women, both within your party and from other parties, and also women's groups, sort of how important were women to you in running and winning?
In my first race, there were five of us that sought the DFL endorsement, and two of us were women. And in my last race and running for governor, there were a bunch of women that ran, and that was good. And I can't say that I had an exclusively different relationship with the women in the race than the men. I had previous relationships with both Auditor Otto, Representative Liebling, but I also had a good and strong relationship with former Speaker Thiessen and with Mayor Coleman. So, those relationships, having those relationships in place ahead of time really, I think, undercuts the heart of the competition. I think holds us to account in our relationships a little bit more, which was important to me. Women, in my very first race, I think the advantage of the fact that I was a woman became an advantage for me because the seat had been represented by Matt and Tenzi for a long time and people were looking for a change and they were thinking about electing a woman. So I did have a slight advantage. I didn't experience that same advantage in the governor's race, although there were a lot of people that were excited about the fact that we might elect a woman for the first time. On the night of the primary, before I went and conceded the race, we were pulling up to the event where we were going to celebrate if we had won. And there was a woman that had volunteered on the campaign a lot, and she was there with her daughter, and she was outside. And her daughter was like 5 years old, and I went over and talked to her about the importance of believing in her own capacity to participate someday and to run for office someday, which is one of the things I love to do along parade routes, to talk with young people about their ability to run. And that mom, you could just see in her eyes, we've got to wait a little bit longer to have this experience for ourselves here in the state of Minnesota. So I think women winning for pro-choice women is a very, very important and strategic organization. I was grateful to be able to work with them, not only in my race, but with other women who were choosing to run. They were a great ally and partner for both Democrats and Republicans pro-choice. And Emily's List was also similarly situated. They worked often here in the state of Minnesota with women who were thinking about running. In our campaign, that we're also a strategic partner in the early part of my race as I was thinking about running, and then when they engaged in the race after we had won the DFL convention. I think women are motivated. They are mobilized probably more than I've ever seen since the 2016 election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, so can you go back to the beginning of the question?
So women are obviously not monolithic, and
yes.
So I'm wondering what sources of support that women gave your campaign from within your own party, the other party, and how important the so-called women's vote was to you.
Okay, because I had a lot of comments about the latter part when Aaron was talking, and I wanted to make sure to get into the beginning. So, Just in terms of support, you know, I went back to calculate because I ran 6 times. I had a male opponent 3 times and a woman 3 times. So that was pretty evenly split. It was a woman who won my seat, or the seat that I held. And then, but I think in terms of help, I had some really key women volunteers on my campaign that were incredibly helpful and just, you know, willing to do whatever needed to be done. And I think that was really crucial. And also just working within their own networks of people that they knew and spreading the word, which was helpful in any candidacy, especially when you start out. You're just trying to reach as many voters as you can. But I think a disadvantage currently, especially for Republican women, Aaron mentioned Emily's List and Women Winning. They're there to support women candidates, but it's really around, I mean, you have to be pro-choice. And for a lot of Republican women that are pro-life, there is no match nationally or locally for that. And so a lot of the groups that have evolved to help women run under the idea of helping women run are really only helping pro-choice women run and not other women who may otherwise be qualified or identify with voters on a lot of other issues. It's really kind of a litmus test there, which I think is unfortunate, and that we don't have sort of other organizations or equal organizations on the other side or just organizations helping women, period, as opposed to creating a litmus on one or other issues. And I think that is something that's missing in the political space.
A few years ago, in the media, there were some high-profile instances of female Minnesota state legislators being the object of sexual harassment. After these episodes, members were required to have some additional training. In what ways have these episodes and the resulting training changed dynamics at the Capitol? And then to follow on with that, how has the Me Too movement more generally changed campaigning's elections and governing? So starting at the Capitol and then broadening to politics more generally.
Yeah. Well, I think it's certainly heightened awareness at the Capitol, and I think, again, you know, the resignation of 2 members, bipartisan resignations, under some pretty damning accusations of sexual harassment, but has heightened awareness. Has it eliminated sexual harassment at the Capitol? I doubt it. I mean, I'm not there now, but I doubt it. I mean, these are some pretty pervasive attitudes, and I think just, you know, it's going to take time and some real effort and focus on that. I do think the leadership there and the leadership of the Republicans when the training started is sincere, and I think there's an effort to try to address it. So I think, you know, certainly the Me Too movement has helped heighten awareness, and I think that's an issue. But, you know, I'll just harken back to one thing that happened during this election. I was a subject of a lot of negative mail from the other party, and one that really bothered me, because it's going to happen anyway, and, you know, you took this vote and it meant this, fine. But one was a mailing basically indicating that I was a mouthpiece or taking voting orders from my husband. Now, my husband is a prominent person in the community. He heads up a major business organization in the state. And he'd been in that job for about three and a half years, and I've been in the legislature 10. So, I mean, but has any male candidate ever had a mailing indicating that they were taking marching orders or voting orders from their wife? And I thought, wow, we have a long way to go yet.
That's what I have to say. I had a similar experience, though not in mail, but by some of my colleagues, both sides of the aisle, when I was the majority leader, suggesting that I was just taking orders from the speaker, just doing the speaker's bidding, not operating independently or on my own, which was pretty amazing, right, at that point in my career. I think the Me Too movement has raised a lot of awareness, but I don't know that it's changed a lot of behavior yet. And the Capitol, for certain, is a place where power is executed, and we see it play out in sexual harassment. And I know, and I won't name names, but a number of my colleagues, former colleagues in the House, who had their own experiences with harassment or prior to being elected with sexual assault, It's something that we would talk about together and quietly. I think the women, and I think about candidate Lindsay Port, who raised the question, really paid us a heavy price for raising the issue of harassment within Senator Schoen. And she is not interested in running for office now because of the experience that she had having raised that question. And I think that's something that we have to pay attention to. I'm grateful for the training that is continuing. I'm grateful for the action that's happening at the Capitol that started last term with then Majority Leader Joyce Pepin, that is continuing now to think about our laws and making sure that they are current. But I just read an editorial in the New York Times over the weekend about the difference in perspective between men and women in the issue of consent. And if we're not clear about consent, then we're going to have a really hard time navigating these issues privately or publicly. And so we have to continue to do that work about what it means to say yes and what it means when you're not saying yes. And the gender difference there was pretty astounding in the research embedded in this op-ed that I read. So we have work to do for sure.
We have a series of questions to both leaders about the parties and the Democratic Party moving to the left, the Republican Party moving to the right, and what do women do who are interested in politics but aren't as liberal as the DFL party is now or aren't as conservative as the Republican Party is or don't like the direction that one of the two parties is going. And so what advice would you give to women who are more moderate from either party when partisan polarization is so high and activists are such an important part of the party base?
So I think this is a central question for us today. And when we think about our politics, when we think about running for office, we think about that continuum of left and center and right. But if you spend your time with the people of Minnesota, and you know, when I have talked with people about running for office, I make sure people understand you've got to be talking with the people who you hope will vote for you and listening to them. Minnesotans aren't living their lives on that same continuum. They're not thinking, I want a left life or a right life. They're leading their lives and trying to navigate and, you know, build a future for themselves and their families. And so when I think about where we are right now in our politics, we absolutely are experiencing political polarization. That is no good for us. And it's not new. We know that. You know, if we look back in history, there's always been, you know, partisan perspectives and polarization. It's at a height right now. But I think for candidates, and the DFL party has always been a Big Ten party from my perspective, and has welcomed people like David Dill, who's no longer alive, very conservative Democrat from way up north, to you know, Karen Clark, who represented a part of Minneapolis for many, many years, and she would be considered very liberal. The Democratic Party had room for that, and within the party, we have to respect that. And make room for those different points of view because they are reflective of the people of Minnesota. And if we're healthy about that and honest about that, we're going to do a better job at representing. But I will say that I think it's important for us as participants in our democracy and people who hope to lead, that when we think about the issues that people are facing right now, healthcare that's too expensive, young people in particular worried about climate change, what do we do about gun violence, right? Those issues are not left, center, right either. There are solutions that get scored as left or right and that undermine our capacity to really deal with the issues because there may be what appears to be a danger as an elected official in moving to a place of making progress. I don't think that's the center. I think that's the progress. And when we have elected officials in a place that are willing to do that, to step away a little bit from a purely partisan ideology to say, I am willing to vote for, stand up for, reach across the aisle and do for this issue in order to make progress, that should be rewarded, right? Applauded and rewarded, and too often it isn't. That's a threatening place for people to be.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree in terms of the polarization. The parties appear to be pulling sort of in the more extreme, whether right or left. And you know, to bring it to more of a local level, I think it, you know, it starts with the local party unit. And it's, that's been a real, I would say, kind of a stick for me, just in terms of the, you know, whole endorsing process and that. I mean, I've been primaried before because I voted against my party platform in supporting same-sex marriage when it came up. And it wasn't a decision made lightly and that, but, you know, I paid a lot of attention to where my community was on the issue, and I voted with where my constituents were, and that was really important to me. And I was primaried over it. Now, I mean, and it is very daunting for a candidate to be opposed by someone in your own party. All elections are hard. I think that was probably the hardest. Because you feel like it's a fight within friends or family. But I think maybe some candidates are too afraid of it also. I mean, sometimes you just have to say, you know what? I'm sorry if you don't agree with me, but I think most people that in the area that I represent do, and so I made this decision, and I'll stand in the primary. And I think most times candidates, if they are paying attention to where their constituents are, will abide or prevail through that process. But at the same time, going back to the endorsing thing, it's often decisions made by few people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's people who mm-hmm. have the time to show up on several Saturday mornings for meetings and that take really a long time. And it's just not a great way to select candidates, you know, because, it tends to be the people who are a little more of the extremes of the party. And so I just don't think that's a good process for winnowing candidates at all. I'd much rather see us move our primary up and have people duke it out there where more people will go to the polls and register their opinion and their vote.
Right. Thank you. You've in some ways already answered part of my next question. Many have noted that there are a series of reforms that could help women candidates in particular. Someone talks about countries where women hold executive political positions. Men actually do a lot more, have a lot more of the domestic responsibilities. I'll also add that there are also party quotas for women in many of the countries with a high percentage of women in the legislature. Other questions asked about the possibility of ranked choice voting. You've mentioned primary reform. Are there any specific policy changes, either sort of domestic policy or electoral policy changes, that you think would really help women run for office and get elected at higher rates?
Oh, gosh, policy changes. You know, none that immediately spring to mind. I have to be honest about that. I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, I think just I chaired education committee for 4 years, and so I was very steeped in that. I do think we could do a better job and need to do more in terms of educating our children on civic engagement and how our government process works and how to be an informed voter and engaged in the process. I think there's a lot more we could do there, and I think that would be an important thing just in terms of, I mean, I wouldn't make it, you know, specific for girls, but I do think that there's some effort that should be made there about the importance of voting and knowing what the issues are and learning about candidates and learning about what your own views are, and that it's okay to change your views over time as well as you gain more information. That's always a good thing to do. But, you know, I don't see... the electorate, and I don't think I'd favor a quota system or anything for women. I just don't think that's a good direction. We want people to run because they're qualified and because they have the right relationship with their community and their voters and a base of support because of their ideas and sort of their work ethic and those things.
The only thing I would add to that, I agree. Is something that I mentioned earlier, and that is the money that's coming into politics, and especially after Citizens United, the decision by the Supreme Court, and I long for a Congress to wrestle with that issue. I really do think if there's money to be spent in campaigns, it should primarily come from the campaigns and the candidates themselves and not so heavily weighted to the groups on the outside and the caucuses who are fighting for or against a candidate. It makes it hard for underfunded candidates to actually compete with their own message and their own voice. And if we want people to support us and vote and participate, they've got to hear from the candidates. And so redistributing that money, maybe a little less of that money, would be a really good reform for our politics in Minnesota and in the United States.
Great. So my final question is sort of reflecting on both of your paths to office. Neither of you strategically planned to run for office back when you were in high school and college, and that's actually pretty consistent with political science research, which shows that men tend to be more strategic, more interested in just running for office to gain power, and women tend to be more driven by particular policy issues to make a change. But yet, women are dramatically underrepresented. So I'm wondering what advice you would give to young women who are thinking about their careers to think a little bit strategically about running for office and not waiting until they're mad about a particular policy issue. And then to follow up on that, I also wonder what advice you would give to the people in this room who are not thinking about running for office but want to help women candidates of either party succeed in running for office.
I will go back to where I began, and I believe deeply in us and our capacity, but our politics and the governing that happens in the state of Minnesota is weaker and I think less fulfilling when we're not in it, and it's not about us. And so in whatever way, whether you choose to write a check, host a house party, make a phone call, go door knocking, speak positively about a politics that you actually believe in. And we could change a lot of people's perceptions if we just talk more about the good that we see and the good that's possible and bring that positive voice. I think that that would do so much for the small d of our democracy. I talk with people all the time, young people in particular, about running for office. And I always think you have to have a why. And I've met, you know, I can name in my mind a number of men who have said to me, I'm going to run, just tell me where I need to live, because I'm going to go. I want to run for office. I like meetings. I'm going to run for office. Kind of funny. A funny reason. You have to know why you're running. And I think that, especially in Minnesota, our legislature is predicated on a citizen government. So do the thing you love and do it well. Get connected in the community in which you live. It isn't so much about showing up at Senate district meetings and working in other elections as it is about being a fully fledged citizen yourself. And when the time is right, you know, the instruments, the infrastructure, how do you raise money, you know, how do you build your first website, et cetera, those things aren't hard to gather together and find. But if you're not here, this is what I believe in, this is what I want to do, this is why I'm going to run for office. If you're not ready to say that part, which is the hardest part, you got to practice that part early. That's the advice that I give to especially young women. Get ready to lead, because we need you.
Yeah, the elevator speech is the hardest thing to hone if you decide to run for office. And but it is important. It is important to really know why you're running. And so I think that's a thing that all candidates need to come to. And really be able to articulate it. And again, I would say it's one of those things, too, where if it's to fulfill a personal need that you have, it's probably not a good idea. I mean, just it's to, I think, really be successful. It's again, more about how can I help address needs in my community? This is a give back type of job and avocation, and that's very much needed. But I think, yes, absolutely. If you, even if you never have any intention of running, and most of us didn't, so, you know, never say never, I always say, you know, time might be right. You should be involved in a campaign at least once in your life. And again, hosting a coffee, go out with a candidate door knocking and see what that's like. I think the voters will have a sort of a new appreciation, anyone who does that, of what it's like to run for office. But it really helps you get to know candidates and people who are seeking public office, and helps hone your sense of kind of what is good and true about our democracy and things that you'd like to change. And it will help bridge some of that gap. I think too often, I think we get people who are more of the party activists who are involved, and there's this wide swath of, I'll just call it the middle, in most of our communities, of people who are not particularly political, and they're not particularly hard right or hard left. They're kind of somewhere in the middle, and they're just looking for people who can be effective and, you know something about, you know, what's important to you or your family. And a lot of those people are not as engaged in the running of campaigns or in the effort of getting people in or and then engaging in the issues for whatever reason. And I think more effort to engage more of that group of people will help with better elected officials and better decisions in politics.
Well, thank you both. Research shows that when adolescent girls observe women running for office, they are actually more likely to talk about politics at home and register higher levels of interest in politics. So you have already done a lot. And of course, thank you so much for your service to the state of Minnesota and for being here today in this excellent discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.